Okay, we start. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the November meeting of the ISB, and we start with fair value measurement.
Sandeep.
Agenda paper 6.
Yes, please.
Sandeep.
Thanks, Hans. So the ISB met in July 2015 to discuss how to proceed with the measurement proposals included in the exposure draft, measuring quoted investments in subsidiaries, joint ventures, and associates at fair value. At the meeting, the ISB tentatively decided that further research should be undertaken with respect to the fair value measurement of quoted investments and the measurement of the recoverable amount of quoted CGUs on the basis of fair value less cost of disposal. For the purposes of undertaking this research, the staff have performed an assessment of the population of entities that would be affected by the proposals in the ED and have gathered input from a wide range of stakeholders. We have conducted outreach with valuation specialists, accounting firms, users of financial statements, securities regulators, the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum, staff of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the Global Preparers Forum, and preparers. The staff will present the outcome of the research in a few board sessions. Today, we will inform the ISB about the outcome from the assessment of the population of entities that would be affected by the proposals in the ED, and the feedback received from valuation specialists, accounting firms, securities regulators, ASAP, and FASB staff. Agenda paper 6A provides a summary of the research undertaken, and agenda paper 6B outlines a detailed analysis of the research findings. In forthcoming meetings, we will provide the ISB feedback received from users, the GPF, and preparers, along with the outcome of the academic literature review. The staff are currently still engaged with user outreach on this topic. We are not asking the ISB to make any decisions at today's meeting. We will first consider the assessment of the population of entities affected by the proposals in the ED. To carry out this assessment, we considered entities that would be affected by the proposals in the ED. This included entities that are required to measure investments in subsidiaries at fair value, or investment entities, those that are permitted to measure investments in joint ventures and associates at fair value, and those that are permitted to measure investments in subsidiaries, joint ventures, and associates at fair value in their separate financial statements. This assessment was carried out on the population of entities included in the S&P Capital IQ database, which contained audited annual reports filed within the last 3 years for 88,258 entities, and involved performing detailed searches on the database by type of entity and by type of investment held by those entities. The assessment did not address quoted CGUs and outlined in the ED and situations in which the measurement proposals would apply as detailed in paragraph 10 of Agenda Paper 6A, because this would have entailed extensive manual procedures, and also extrapolating any conclusions from the outcomes of these other situations would not be appropriate because some of these instances represent one-time transactions. Overall, the assessment showed that it is not common for investment entities, venture capital organizations, mutual funds, unit trusts and similar entities, and non-investment entities to have interests in quoted investments. To provide you with a bit more detail, of the 2,559 investment entities in the database, only 2.03% reported under IFRS and had investments in quoted subsidiaries, and only 3.91% reported under IFRS and held investments in quoted joint ventures and associates. The assessment carried out for non-investment entities considered an initial population of 85,699 entities. We noted that only 2.66% of non-investment entities reported under IFRS and had investments in quoted subsidiaries, while only 1.66% reported under IFRS and had investments in quoted joint ventures and associates. Because non-investment entities have a measurement option in their separate financial statements when accounting for the investments in subsidiaries, joint ventures and associates, we sampled the separate financial statements of 50 non-investment entities and noted that all 50 entities sampled had chosen cost to measure their quoted investments. Without considering the situations described in paragraph 10 of Agenda Paper 6A, the assessment of the population of entities that would be affected by the proposals in the ED reflects that they would affect only a limited number of entities, and those entities would be primarily investment entities. Because non-investment entities seem to be predominantly using cost as the measurement basis when accounting for quoted investments in their separate financial statements. This conclusion is further corroborated by the feedback received from accounting firms, ASAF members, and securities regulators. Similar comments were received from these constituents on the question of how prevalent are CGUs that correspond to quoted entities. The majority of the parties contacted mentioned that such a case is possible, but rare. With regard to other feedback received from stakeholders, the common denominator was that measuring the fair value of quoted investments by applying P times Q does not necessarily result in a measurement that is relevant for the unit of account being measured at fair value, i.e. the investment as a whole. For many of the parties contacted, P times Q is a relevant reference but is used mainly as a reasonableness check when measuring quoted investments and quoted CGUs, but it is not necessarily used as the primary technique. Valuation specialists noted that they generally use the discounted cash flow method when measuring the fair value of quoted investments, and that P times Q was rarely used as the primary valuation technique. They would typically reconcile any differences between the measurement obtained by using a valuation technique and the measurement derived by applying P times Q. They also commented that some adjustments that are included to capture some features of the investment, such as control, involved a high degree of judgment, and that in some cases the availability of supporting evidence is limited. Accounting firms reiterated the messages included in their comment letters to the ED that P times Q is not a relevant measurement for the investment as a whole, because there is no level one price for that unit of account. Similar comments were also provided regarding the measurement of the recoverable amount of quoted CGUs. Some ASAF members commented that the proposed measurement was not a relevant measure because of its inconsistency with the unit of account being the investment as a whole. A few ASAF members supported the relevance of P times Q in instances in which investments are not disposed as a block or when the control premium, if applicable, was relatively small. For CGUs, ASAF members commented that the relevance of the proposed measurement would depend on how closely aligned the CGU and the quoted entity were, and highlighted that a consequence of such proposals would be a lack of alignment between the measurement of the recoverable amount of quoted and unquoted CGUs. For one of the securities regulators contacted, and for some of the members of the second securities regulator contacted, P times Q is the preferred measurement method because of its verifiability, reliability, and objectivity. In most of the cases, those securities regulators also think that P times Q is an appropriate method for measuring the recoverable amount of quoted CGUs. So, to conclude, the results arising from the research work carried out highlighted two main messages. Firstly, excluding those instances described in paragraph 10 of Agenda Paper 6A, the proposals in CD are likely to affect only a very limited number of entities. And secondly, the majority of parties contacted so far do not think that the resulting measurement from applying P times Q is a relevant measurement. And with that, I would now like to hand the discussion over to the board.
Tango?
The first conclusion, I'm not sure whether it is correctly reflect the reality. The reason is, you know, as I understand, you know, in the case of value the joint venture holdings at P times Q or not, I think it's related to two different markets. One market is there is a possibility you can trade, you know, unit of one shares, and then P times Q will be relevant to some extent, like you say, to use as a check. But on the other hand, there is another huge market where the shares actually traded as a block, not sell piece by piece. You know, I'm not sure in the other market, in China, there are huge markets we call second tier or third market. And the company or the hedge fund or others, you know, originally invest in, you know, different kind of private entities, and we call the seed money. And they invest in the company as a block with 5%, 10%, they want to sell it. And in the second case, there is no P times Q at all. So I'm not sure whether the investigation truly reflects the whole populations we are talking about. You know, I think these two are closely related. Firstly, the population you are saying is very small. I'm not sure whether it is correct. And secondly, if you ignore the second type of transaction, that means you know, exchange by block rather than by shares, then it will be totally wrong. So I think my main focus will be on the second type. You know, this is to a large extent why from beginning I support Martin's view. You know.
Daryl.
I think the exercise is very useful. I think it's provided a lot of useful information. That said, I think for me, probably a lot of what I read in here was more confirmatory than anything that was revelationary. Revolutionary. There was nothing in here that I necessarily was surprised to read. But I think along the lines of to an extent what Wago said, I think it is correct that this is likely to be a very small population that essentially we're looking for subsidiaries or associates carried at fair value, which is an unusual circumstance in our literature. The concern for me is, and perhaps a question for you, in terms of the next level of research, and it might be very similar to what you've said, I would imagine that just below the significant influence mark, there are an awful lot of blocks of shares that are held that in accordance with our literature are carried at fair value, and that I think many of the analysts, many of the auditors, many of the valuation specialists that you've spoken to would equally conclude that P times Q provides a certain element of the information, it provides a certain part of the data, but does not provide a full picture. And I think part of my concern with something like this is we may think about going ahead with a change that affects a very, very narrow population, but in doing so, we're changing a principle that affects, to my mind, a much broader population. And it's that population of holdings that can be defined as blocks, but are not defined as a different unit of account in our literature.
Mm. Well, yes, we acknowledge that when we were gathering the feedback from the different parties, of course, those blocks of shares were not falling within the scope of our research because we were focusing on investments in subsidiaries, JVs, and associates. So our understanding, though, is that the measurement of those blocks, if they are traded, are not posing that many questions, and people would be following P times Q. So.
Can I confirm, though, in part it is because the nature of our literature by defining a subsidiary or defines a separate unit of account for that, which raises a question which might lead to diversity. But I think the questions you ask people here is, do they think that P times Q produces the right outcome? And it's in that space. So I think in shareholdings that fall below the significant influence, my suspicion is there's very little diversity because our literature is very clear, but I think that the answer to the questions you've asked here about whether P times Q is appropriate might have actually been similar for those blocks.
Yeah, absolutely, Daryl, because that opens up the bigger question of whether you have block discount and where you can bring that in. But I think when we were looking at the ED, we weren't looking to expand that. It was the conflict between the unit of account that we have and the measurement in terms of P times Q. Because that by itself is a much broader question, and it brings up anybody who's fair valuing any kind of equity holding which they have, which is level one. And I don't think that's what the ED was, and that's why we stayed there.
And Kumar, I do agree with that. I think one of the reasons why I had a concern around the direction the ED, around changing this measurement, was that I then create this little 2.7% or 3.7% anomaly out there on the edge.
And you're not concerned that in those other block transactions, P times Q might not give the right answer? Or?
My view here would be that if we are going to look at this, we need to be looking at it across the breadth of investment holdings that it affects.
Pretty much the same comments. I'm not surprised at all by the findings. I think the population of investment entities and the like which control listed subsidiaries is probably small. But like my colleagues, I think that many of the transactions that will be conducted on the shares will be through brokers outside the market by blocks. Brokers will trade blocks at a price which usually is different from the price on the retail market. Those prices will be communicated to the market authority or to the stock market and will be included in the pricing, but afterwards only, not before. So they will influence the market, but they will not reflect the price at which you transacted before. I think we could do some more research, maybe by contacting stock exchanges like Euronext or London Stock Exchange to get more information about the extent of trading of blocks, how this works, and how it influences the price, the P, afterwards. We could learn a lot from that. I'm not sure that for the vast population, the fact that they may trade blocks instead of going to the market directly, hence get a different price from the market price, does that mean we should change the valuation, the principle in the standard? Maybe not, because so far no one has complained about the P times Q outside of the new developments for listed subsidiaries. But I think for the new developments resulting from IFRS 10, 11, and the amendment for investment entities were really have a big problem to solve. I'm not sure how to do it, but clearly what we proposed seems to be not acceptable by the majority of respondents.
But I thought I heard Daryl say that if we solve it for the joint ventures, etc., significant influence, that we would also have to look at P times Q for all these other transactions that nobody's complaining about.
My concern here is to the extent that we choose to solve it for this small population, essentially that's an explicit statement that we think there is something that is better than P times Q in any block type situation. Yeah. And that seems to me to suggest we should be solving it for everything rather than just for this very small subset.
We could also conclude then we are going to solve a very small issue and create a lot of unrest for the rest of the market, where P times Q is at least a much better approximation than for these transactions where control is an issue.
And there is no complaint.
Of course, there are price differences between block trades and individual share trades, but they're usually not so big and transitory. And you never know whether they are going to be traded again in blocks or in individual shares. So I wonder if we were not going to make the problem bigger rather than smaller if we if we go that way. Sue?
I wasn't very surprised by what's in the papers, but just a couple of thoughts. I think we need to be careful to remember what we started out trying to do and keep that in mind and sort of not get, I hope, too carried away. My recollection is that we started off with a relatively narrow question because people were worried there could be diversity in practice and the application of the standard because of a perceived lack of clarity between how IFRS 13 interacted with the scope of other standards, and so we set out to try and address that. I think given the feedback we've got in terms of what people are doing, but also the narrowness of the issue in the practice, I'm not sure we've got a big issue with diversity of application at all. So I think we should remember that. The thing that worries me is that we've, in asking people what they think is relevant, of course they've all come back and said we don't think it's relevant, but I think similar to what Daryl's saying, if I went out and asked people if they thought that what we do for block discounts is relevant, they'd also give me the same answer. And that was a long and difficult battle for the two boards on block discounts, and I don't think we want to go there. But it's because we've asked this relevance question. And I guess I'm a bit worried about opening this up at this point in time for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I'm not sure why, given the narrow scope of what we started out looking at, we're looking at now before we do a post-implementation review of IFRS 13, which I think we're planning to start next year, where we could get some broader feedback in terms of issues in IFRS 13. Also, I don't think we've got a divergence issue. I also think that it goes absolutely to the heart of what's in IFRS 13, and I think we'd be creating divergence. My understanding, even though we don't talk about it specifically in the paper, is that in the US, P times Q is used in these circumstances for fair value measurement. Something different happens with impairment, but for fair value measurement. So we'd be having a converged standard and unilaterally going and making decisions which are at the heart of our fair value measurement literature, which I'm not sure we should do without very careful consideration. Also, the other thing that struck me, when I picked up this paper is, if ever there was something that caused me to be cautious in our next steps, it's hearing what people are doing today, because I'm not sure how much of it, I'm not sure how much is valuation practice versus financial reporting. But what we're seeing people do is not maximising the use of observable prices. It's one thing to say, I don't think P times Q unadjusted is the right answer, but then to go away from even using the P and coming from a mark to model perspective.
But didn't they say they use it as a reasonable fullness?
Ish. I'm not sure that's the case. And certainly at ASAF, some stuff that would suggest otherwise was coming up at the table. We'd be losing the anchor that at least we have in IFRS 13, or risk losing that anchor if we suddenly change this. And everybody, just about everybody who's raising this is talking about premiums. They've all got upside in mind. And in my mind, I would have thought it would be more symmetrical than that. So
yeah,
that makes me, given the amount of flack we get for how robust fair value measurement numbers are, I just wouldn't be going lightly into moving away from P times Q in this space by ourselves pre a full analysis of IFRS 13.
Can I just make one, we cover it in the paper. The PIR, which has been completed for the US side, did not find an issue problem with this issue, especially on the expanded scope area. So what we looked at was just this issue of the unit of account and how does that measure up with that.
Okay, yes. Question here.
Yeah.
How frequent is it in the US to have a control of a listed subsidiary? To my opinion, it's extremely rare that a listed entity is controlled by another one.
Listed
entity being controlled by another entity. In my opinion, the US is extremely rare. Is it true or not?
Don't know off the cuff, Philippe, but what I have seen, and I'll bring that back later, is that they do have some control premium parameters around because of the acquisitions. But on a regular basis, I don't know. I've got to check.
Wouldn't you, if you consolidated the sub, you'd have to have control, wouldn't you?
The sub is usually not listed. Once you take control in the US,
you like to get 100%.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
it's a privately held, you know.
Yeah. I think there would be some instances. I don't know how. No, not like what? Not one in a million, but I think not typical, but not. They're not forced buyouts, for example, minorities.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. Generally very nice paper, you know, analyzing every aspect of the issue. However, I'd like to maybe some suggestions on the improvement of the paper, the analysis paper. First one is some criticism on this P times Q are mixed with some kind of criticism on general model of fair value measurement. So as a concern, there, especially for example, some valuation expertise specialists are saying the fair value model generally has some kind of problems, not just P times Q. It's so maybe if we separate those criticisms, the specific on our P times Q model and the other general model. That's the one suggestion. Another one is the number of population might be affected by this P times Q. If there's some change in this P times Q model, maybe much the less than number you found here. Maybe, for example, you said about 56 companies, the final number. Yeah, but among them, if they use P times Q model, maybe among them, maybe 30 companies are using P times Q model. The others are using some kind of adjustment to P times Q model. So if we change our conclusion, the only 30 companies will be affected. So I'm saying the precise analysis of the population then might be affected by the P times Q model change, but still to follow, you have to follow the more detailed. So another thing is, as I said before, if we change this P times Q model, then maybe I'm saying there's no any quoted investment that may be applied by P times Q model, because most of the quoted investment is made with debt in a kind of block rather than just one individual stock is a transacted. So maybe anytime if you have a kind of bunch of equity investments, then we need some kind of adjustment to this P times Q amount. So generally, I felt, based on this good analysis, investors would like to have, if we change the P times Q model, would like to have two numbers. One is V times Q and some adjustment. If investors have such information, they are very happy. They can do, they have all kinds of information, subjective adjustment, and that some kind of P times Q, very objective numbers. So that's what their maybe investors would like to have. And sometimes, maybe some group, if they have some kind of specialized interest, for example, valuation expertise, they would like to have some kind of adjustment. Otherwise, they don't have any contribution to the measurement of P times Q or fair value of some amounts. One similar issue was raised in the maybe last year from Germany. The measuring the some kind of value of the corporate bonds. If we make any adjustment by this kind of valuation experts, they will be classified as level 2 or level 3 fair value. So they have cancelled their. I'm saying, this is kind of some strategic issues rather than in addition to some measurement issues too. So basically, I'm saying, maybe the P times Q model in IFRS 3 might not be perfect, but it's a very good alternative, practically. So if we do some kind of adjustment to that P times Q, then everything is becoming some kind of subjective. So as I said, there'll be a positive, plus or minus, premium discounts, but nobody would like to interest in this kind of a subjective adjustment. That's why I'm saying, if we are going to adjust this P times Q model, then we need to disclose both some P times Q and plus some adjustment. Then investor will be happy.
But the P is available to the investor anyway. So the investor can do that calculation by themselves. I don't think we need to make a big fuss of it financially.
But we are using that number on the face of balance sheet now. We are presenting the P times Q numbers on the face of balance sheet. So we are going to add some adjustment. So if we are going to make some adjusted amount on the balance sheet, then maybe, as you said, maybe they might calculate the P times Q by their own steam. But still, if you provide some kind of information, that would be better for them.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. And it's really around the application of fair value measurement. So I'm going to IFRS 13. The principle in IFRS 13 says valuation techniques used to measure fair value shall maximize the use of relevant observable inputs, minimize the use of unobservable. So hence, we're in the situation where we have these level one inputs, and it's incumbent upon us, the preparer, to use them. But then we go on to say that an entity shall select inputs, and I'm assuming this also takes into consideration level one, that are consistent with the characteristics of the asset or liability that market participants would take into consideration in a transaction. And we separate the types of characteristics between size or blockage as saying, no, those aren't valid adjustments, from examples, we have EG in parens, control premiums, okay, as an example. So my question is, are we talking at cross purposes? In other words, are we saying that, in fact, you can, okay, use level one inputs, but in fact, if there is a characteristic of the underlying investment that you think needs to be adjusted, you would do so.
Yeah.
So is, in fact, the idea of adjusting a level one input contrary to the principle in IFRS 13? That's my question.
I would have an answer for you, but I think many constituents, what are they saying is that for them, the anchor of IFRS 13 is not necessarily the availability of a level one price if that level one price is not aligned with the unit of account that they are measuring. For them, the anchor is paragraph 14 of IFRS 13 that states that an entity should consider the unit of account of the item that is measuring at fair value. So this is the first step for them. Consider the item that you are measuring, and based on that, then incorporate in the fair value measurement the features of this item.
Attention, we've got those patterns that IFRS, IAS 28, etc., all sends you back to IFRS 9, and IFRS 9 says P times Q. So that's where we have this tension between us saying the unit of account is the group, you know, the block, if you like, the whatever, the unit as a whole. But then that literature sends you back to IFRS 9, and IFRS 9 is black and white P times Q. So you're right, there is a tension because of that. But that's why we got where we did in the exposure draft, which was to say because it sends you back to 9, 9 says P times Q. And so it sort of overrides that control premium.
The issue is, I guess, IFRS 9, would it apply to an investment in a joint venture or a subsidiary?
Well, that's what the ED confirmed. The ED confirmed that because you get sent back to IFRS 9, it's P times Q. That is what the board discussed.
That's the conflict.
I agree, and so I'm not quite so sure then those who say that the adjustment of a level one input are completely wrong.
No, can I just come with...
From a relevant standpoint, if you look at the economic characteristics of what you're investing in and what you own, you look at the rights and restrictions of a pool of cash flows, not individual instruments added up times a price. So I think we have to resolve this issue. I don't think, whether or not we punt it to a PIR or not is, I think, another question, it's a process question. But from just a technical standpoint, I think we should acknowledge there is clearly a problem.
Can I just come in two things? One of the things that comes in, but I agree, and this is the fundamental challenge. What people will argue is that for this unit of account, I don't have level one prices. So therefore, I can adjust them. That's the challenge. If we say that you have level one prices, then I think the IFRS 13 will also go and say that those are the prices you use because that matches your unit of account. And generally, 13 will say that the markets dominate. If you have market prices, those are the best prices. So fundamentally, without going into this, and Sue is absolutely right, IFRS 13 says the unit of account follows the standard where you are measuring. That takes it to 28, which is the investment, and then it brings it to 9, which says P into Q, and that's why the ED came up. So that is the tension. So the tension is that in this case, if the unit of account is the investment as a whole, then people will argue this doesn't have a level one price. So I'm not constrained by that. So we have adjustments. And that was also discussed in the ED, and where I think we will certainly bring back the consistency of whatever we do with 13 when we come back to the board for some kind of decision.
I accept all that. I just want to dispel the assertion that P times Q has theoretical primacy here. I don't think that that's a valid assertion.
We don't want to think about all these valuation experts being out of business if we continue the P times Q. Mm-hmm. Martin?
And in paragraph 25, I think it is also what was my main argument why I dissented to this ED, because Manzetti is saying in the last part of this thing is, in addition, valuation specialists typically noted that P times Q would not represent an exit price for investments in subsidiaries, joint ventures, and associates, because the principal market for the sale of those holdings would not be the open market, but instead markets such as, for example, the mergers and acquisition markets. And that, for me, is the main point. And therefore, if we're changing that, we are not against the principles, core principles of IFRS 13, because there is not any observable market, and really the open market is not the exit market for this kind, if you look at the investment as a whole. If we look at a one share or a one piece, then maybe it is. But we had decided, okay, it is an investment as a whole, and an investment as a whole, the exit market is not really the open market. And therefore, it's a principle, we cannot apply that. And that is, I think, the main issue. The second point I want to make is, and this research is saying, okay, that it is rare that we have kind of entities which have that. I agree to that, but I think we should not forget if an entity has this case, the impact could be very material for them. So maybe the number is rare, but really the impact is really material if it happens.
But you have to measure the value of this block of shares when they own it and are not about to sell it, or perhaps they are about to sell it, but
we have
normally they own it.
Fair value
and
is
how
an exit
do you
price.
Know whether it's going to be...
Fair value is an exit price.
Yeah.
And then the question is...
Is it going to be a discount, or is there going to be...
No. What is the right market for that?
Yeah.
Because my point is, you cannot, on the open market, you cannot sell if you have, for example, 80% of a kind of...
But I agree with Sue that there is an assumption that it will increase the value of the block of shares. But it could very well, if you want to get rid of a block of shares, why is all this block trading going on in dark pools, etc.? Because they are worried if we unload it on the market, it will depress the price. So I'm not so sure that it's necessarily going to be a
higher
price.
But it's a circle. If, for example, if a company would announce that it, through the open market, they want to sell, let's assume they have 80% of a kind of a listed entity, and they announce through the open market, they want through the open market really sell this 80%. Do you think the current, before this announcement, the share price of this would be reflective of that?
Absolutely not.
Martin, I don't disagree with you, but I think it was almost exactly the sentence you've picked on that led me to think that that's right, but it's probably exactly the same if I have a 10% holding or a 15% holding. If I announce it, So my difficulty here is I think we're looking at the top of the iceberg and we're sort of almost ignoring everything else underneath.
I think it's extreme.
I don't think
sell one share and you say maybe if you have control.
You want
I think
to open
maybe
the
we cannot solve everything.
I think most
but
of
that can't be solved the extremes.
Most of the transactions we're talking about, most of the volume, most of the big holdings, most of the impact on companies is in that range just below the significant influence. And I think it's exactly right. The sentence is precisely. It's traded in a market outside of... You don't want to announce it, you don't want to have a big hoo-ha, and you will almost certainly sell it at a different price.
I'd be much less concerned if people were saying, I'm going to look at P times Q, and then I'm going to explain how I need to adjust that to give the picture of my holding. But people aren't saying that. People are saying, I'm going to put that aside, I'm going to come up with a discounted cash flow analysis, and I'm going to start thinking about how I might change the capital structure and make fundamental differences to this thing, and that's going to be the number I'm going to put in my financial statements. We are the ones who are going to pay the price when the numbers turn out not to be very good.
And we already have an instance of that now happening.
Ian? Yeah, I think this is a good debate. We've had it before, by the way. And
yes.
I think exactly. Points made are quite relevant, but we should remember where we are. In July, we asked the staff to carry out some research. And they've gone away, and I think they've come up with a good paper. And I don't think we can dispute the conclusions. You could dispute on the numbers, maybe. I think Sue's warning about, but hang on, this could be a bigger question. They've investigated what we asked them to investigate.
Yep.
And they haven't finished. We've got another paper to come next month with more research. So let's stay calm for a little while. We're not sitting here making decisions today, and I think the points that have been made should be kept in mind. The post-implementation review of 13, I think, is a very good point. I'm quite disappointed to hear that the US has done theirs already, and we're not there. and Daryl's point about, there's not just the market that the CED was looking at, there's an effect on others. I think we need to keep in mind, but we don't need to resolve all those issues today. We just need to accept the paper or not, and some people have made some comments on what other way it could be looked at, and wait with great anticipation for the paper next month, which extends the research.
Tuck?
Thank you. I just want to be incremental. Changu pointed out a very good point. if we could provide two types of information to the users, that would be useful. And I think it's true. So then two types of information is, one is P times Q, and the other is adjusted amount. But there is two ways of doing it. So first alternative is put the adjusted amount on the balance sheet and make a disclosure of P times Q and reconcile it. And the other way, the other one is put the P times Q P times Q on the balance sheet and then ask the reconciliation to the what you think adjusted amount. And I think the first choice, I don't think first choice would work, because even if you require reconciliation, as it is written in the paper, preparer would only say the difference is the control premium or something. It doesn't work. So then, but if you go to the second choice, then preparer has to explain why you think this adjustment amount is useful information. And also, I have an impression that most of the regulators prefer the P times Q. So I think this is because of their population. I think regulators grab the population right. So therefore, I think we stick to ED rather than changing it drastically.
Gary?
Yeah, thank you. By the way, I thought a really good paper. It, actually, I was a bit surprised by the results, but surprise isn't, the market's actually a lot smaller than I might have thought it was. You know, if I know you got more work to do, but if the results came out where we are right now, there's sort of an underwhelming endorsement to proceed. It is the way I would conclude it, that the market is small, the non-investment companies do what it costs, and so on. So putting aside, you know, congruent, if you will, with IFRS 13. If we drop the project, what are the consequences? And I do acknowledge Daryl's point, the real market might be, you know, the next level down, but that might be, that's going to be hard to see, you know, what, for one thing, because companies generally don't, you know, cost-based investments are just buried other assets, but not, and so on, but what would the implications be if we did not proceed? Again, I appreciate that the IFRS 13 principles, but any other ones?
We go.
Now, I fully agree with what Pat just said. You know, whether the P times Q is theoretically, what's the term you use? In terms of relevance, privacy. What I question, it during the board discussion for develop 13, even though I lost, but I never accept, the P times Q is always the best. Because when you look at the basis, I still remember the reason why the board finally reject is not purely from relevance point of view. Because subjectivity, this is the one reason. This is why the paper say the regulators also express their concern about if we not use this one, these principles. And secondly, we still have to be careful, about the debate on ourselves. In the case where P always there, what I emphasize again, there is a market. There's no P. At all, market transact on blockage. For example, Alibaba hold by, 100 jump the hedge funds. Goldman may hold 3%. The Martin may hold 5%. And Waco may hold 10%.
Very rich men.
They wouldn't be here. Martin said they wouldn't be here.
He's on the Bahamas.
5% of Alibaba.
Each of us want to sell in a centralized market. It's quoted. There is a level one, but there is no 1P there because they're not traded. There's no such a market traded at P or at one share. This is what I try to emphasize. The final point I want to emphasize is about premium and discount. I clearly remember when the board discussed this, and when when the staff dropped that paper, I come to hearing. I said, why you only mention premium rather than discount? And here he said, Wilco, don't worry, this is only example. I'm not sure final wording. You know, she said, you know, of course there is possibilities, you know, if, you know, for some reasons sell at discount. It is quite understandable. So my the memory is clearly answer my question, say, you know, this is only example. So not create a confusion among everybody.
Just a couple of points. I think absolutely agree with the first point you're making, Vigu. I think that's a battle out here which we are discussing, and we will just bring that back, as Ian said later, is the issue of reliability versus what you're doing. Second, regarding whether we have quoted prices for blocks which would meet level one, I would like to just put a marker down. I doubt very much whether those would be level one prices, because they're not traded in an active market. So you could have block trades, but I don't think they're level one prices. So if you're not level one, that becomes a different issue altogether. And again, it will, as you rightly said, it works both ways, premiums or discounts. It's not just premiums.
Excuse me, why is a trade in a dark pool, a trade off market, why isn't it level one? Why? It's a real trade. It's observable.
It's but the point.
It's not active. Okay.
It's not an active market. I doubt if people will say these are observable trades, because
they're observable. They are brought to the market data. They are observable. Maybe not liquid. Maybe not liquid. Maybe.
Could be. Philippe, agree. Some dark pools report to the market, and you have these what you were referring to as the iceberg trade rules. Not all dark pools do.
Stephen.
Tack mentioned earlier about P times Q in the balance sheet and other information in the notes. Has your research looked at the number of companies that do provide at the moment alternative measures in the notes, and how many of these companies use non-GAAP measures to communicate what they think is the real value for the investments?
No, it's just purely a population assessment, but it's something that we can explore.
We can look at it, Steve, but we'll have to do that on a sample basis, because I don't think we'll have to run
sure.
a database.
Yeah.
Absolutely agree. My comment to Tuck's side is that the other side is the companies can always disclose it if they have this data. Let's see. But we'll come back to you on that. We haven't been able to do it.
Larry?
I just want to step back and kind of with Ian's caution in mind about this is research, not decision making. We're getting more research that I thought it was very useful to have a quantification of, precise, but of the extent of the potential for this issue. And I think, well, I take Martin's point that there may be relatively few, but for them it's significant. I think that would be, that's a concern to weigh if we decide that we want to go ahead to finalize the amendment, because what we've heard is that they're all doing the thing that they think is most relevant for their block measurement. Given the size of this and given all the other issues, certainly the quantification of how many companies are affected leads me to say that this is something we should say on this basis. I don't think we need to pursue it further. I'm prejudging the rest of the research, but it also leads me to say, let's not ask the staff to do huge amounts of additional research into how markets work and the information value of different kinds of pricing, because to me the question that we try to resolve diversity in practice is about the interaction of accounting literature, not a reconsideration of the relevance of different pieces of market data. Obviously, we want to be thinking about what the subject matter is, but you know, it really was the how do these pieces of literature get stitched together. I am a little concerned to understand how people, when required to measure things at fair value, are going about it, and the greater amount of subjectivity than I would have thought in light of IFRS 13. But that's a caution that I think comes out in terms of thinking about how we design the PIR for IFRS 13. And also maybe thinking about another project that we've got kicking around on our agenda, which is about requests for additional flexibility for investment entities in terms of what are not measured at fair value. So I'd just say when we're working on that project, we need to think about some of the findings here. But I also would caution for any further research we're doing, I thought that the information about the extent of the issue was very useful. Information about what people are doing today and what they're thinking is was useful. I think the comment letter process is the time when we should be asking people for their opinions on what's relevant, and there seemed to be an awful lot of time spent in these papers inviting people to re-argue their views about, in effect, IFRS 13, and I think that's more for the PIR than for research on the accounting. So in terms of the weight of research coming back, I think it's the first two pits that were the more useful parts of the papers.
I was just going to circle back to something Weigo said about the original IFRS 13 deliberations, and I was only involved in bits of it at the tail end, but my recollection was in the context of block discounts, which was where there was a lot of discussion, there was a very extensive discussion really that came down to the importance of relevance versus measurement uncertainty and how those two things were weighed up. And so I think that the measurement uncertainty piece of it weighed a lot into where the board ended up. And I think partly sort of building on what Mary said, because we've gone and asked people about the relevance bit, it's sort of giving a slight...
Was the requirement?
Yeah. It's slightly different to the basis for which the decisions were made, and that's why I'm just a bit anxious.
Well, obviously, more work needs to be done. All I would like to say is, as we seek for perfection in this issue, it is a relatively small issue, and although P times Q may not be perfect, it is a hell of a lot better than the vast majority of assets and liabilities that are valued at historic cost, which are the reasons why they're with every acquisition, there's a lot of goodwill, which we're going to talk about yesterday. And what also worries me a bit is that people always find reasons to say that market values are not particularly relevant, either for a choice for a historic cost or, in this case, to be able to make up numbers that are different from market numbers, and usually with the expectations that they would be higher. So anyway,
we'll bring that.
So I think the reliability question is extremely important as we go forward, with this. And also knowing that the perfect solution probably does not exist. All right.
Okay.